Join the National U Institute for our Foundations of Freedom Regional Seminars in California. We're stopping in Newport Beach on April 30th and then in San Jose on May 1st. These half-day conferences take place from 2:30 to 6:30 p.m. and feature me, Rich Lowry, and Ramesh Panuru, along with Judge Janice Rogers Brown, John Yu of Berkeley Law, and Will Swaim of the California Policy Center. Register at nrinstitute.org. That's nrinstitute.org. Hope to see you there.
Bienvenidos. That's California for welcome. Sorry to shock you there, David. February 28th edition of National Review's Radio Free California podcast. We have the speaker turned up a little loud here. I'm Will Swaim, president of the California Policy Center. You can find my colleagues and me at californiapolicycenter.org. You can find my friend and co-host David Bonson right here. He's an economist, the host of the Capital Record podcast, author of the new book, Full Time, Work and the Meaning of Life, and of course, founder of the eponymous investment firm, The Bonson Group. Hello, David.
Hello, Will. It is wonderful to be with you in person.
In person, in the same room. David, lots to get to here very, very quickly. Let's start with the fact that Donald Trump took some time out at CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Group, and to blast California and Gavin Newsom. That's, in fact, the headline of a fact check story from this is the Sacramento Bee. And the reporter, the headline is "What Was and Was Not True When Donald Trump Blasted California, Gavin Newsom at CPAC." David, there are three or four points the reporter raises to kind of fact check Trump. And I got to tell you, as much as it makes my skin crawl, Trump is mostly right on these things that they say he got wrong.
Well, you're probably going to establish that. I just was going to say before we went through it, just at a coin flip level of evaluating Trump saying something and then a reporter fact checking.
Yes.
Who gets the the benefit of the doubt? And I don't think I can answer that. I would just be like, I don't know.
It's so funny. So here are the I'll say four items. Number one, what Trump said at CPAC was that he hopes that Gavin Newsom will run for president. He said, a lot of people think Gavin Newsom is going to run in a certain way. I hope so, too. I hope so because he's destroyed America. The SACB reporter says, you know, basically that's false. Newsom has repeatedly said he's not running for president in November. Well, Trump didn't say he was. He said he hoped he would. They're very different things. Second, it was that Trump says something about mansions. He says basically that people are being invited in and Newsom is saying, if you come up here, I shouldn't even do an impersonation. I'm so sorry. If you come up here, we're going to give you pension funds. We're going to have pensions. We'll give you a mansion. Do you ever see the things that Newsom is promising? Free health care, free education? Who the hell wouldn't? I may move here, might move there myself, actually. The reporter goes on to, in very dry and bureaucratic tones, tell us that Newsom has not actually promised mansions for immigrants arriving in the U.S. unlawfully. I call that misunderstanding hyperbole, because, in fact, the reporter does acknowledge that, in fact, you can get into California and get all kinds of benefits. And that's really, I think, any reasonable reporter wouldn't even try to fact check.
To me, if I were on the side of open borders and on the side of a magnet of the welfare state for illegal immigrants, and I knew it was an unpopular position, and then there was some of this stuff going on, and a critic of it used the word mansions, I would be deathly afraid of saying, come on, it's not mansions.
Yeah.
Because I wouldn't want to draw attention to what it was.
Yes, exactly.
Like now everyone who's talking about it is saying, oh, man, guess what? What a burn. It wasn't mansions, Trump. It was this other thing that's also like really unattractive to the voting public.
Yes. Yeah. Let's see. So it's former President Donald Trump in a lengthy and falsehood-riddled speech. Lengthy and falsehood-riddled. No mansions. But what we do offer in California, of course, is free health care benefits to illegal and undocumented people. You can get a job in some states, some places in the state, as we established in last week's episode in San Francisco. You don't have to be a citizen to vote in municipal elections. You can be here as undocumented or, you know, resident alien.
And that isn't a state thing, though. That wasn't Gavin.
No. That's correct. Yeah. But the point is that we have set up, as you said, a menu of incentives to encourage people to come here. And Trump is really pointing that out. You know, I may move there myself. Who wouldn't want that, he says.
Yeah.
And then the reporter takes issue with the fact that Trump says he was told by a congressman he did not name. That's a classic Trump storytelling style. That this person told him, they have so much water in California. I said to some of our great congressmen that asked me to help them with a problem up in that area, up in the north of California, I said, I see you have a drought. And they said, no, we don't have a drought. We have so much water, you don't know what to do. But they send it out to the Pacific. We're not going to let them get away with that any longer. That's actually somewhat true. It is fair to say that we have had a drought. It's not that there is no drought. We have droughts here periodically in California, and as far as we can tell, historically, always have had droughts, cycles of drought. And it's also true that we mismanage our water, which was really, again, the point of the story. Not no drought, but SACB reporter determined to hammer the round peg of climate change into the square hole of, you know, whatever Donald Trump is talking about. So I would argue that Trump got that one mostly right, that it is about water mismanagement. The fact that he says he can fix it means that he understands it's mismanagement and not God's gift to creation in the form of precipitation. And then the final thing that...
You know what, though? Okay, he's right. But what I think happened is the top part was where it says that they have so much water... He said, no, yeah. What I think is a congressman said, this drought is being made worse by the politicians, something like that. Like, not like we don't have a drought or we never had a drought.
Right.
But the politician spoke with hyperbole, and Trump then repeated it as a literal.
Mm.
And so you get this reporter kind of nitpicking at something that isn't very substantive.
Right.
That's my opinion.
Yes.
But I think on the merits, you're right about that. Those are the only examples. No, there's another one. What else was it? Elections?
The last one was stolen elections. And on that one, the reporter is correct. There is no evidence. The election was stolen. It was primarily poking fun at California and saying this was outside the normal stolen election narrative. This was it in California. We've got problems. You know, he says, how many people from California know people that got 6, 7, 8 ballots?
Zero. That's the answer.
Yeah, exactly.
And just so you know, the credibility of him about the stolen election stuff, he said he won California in 2016.
Right.
So the 2020 thing is ridiculous, and we've seen that, and they lose all the court cases, and, you know, there were some close states, but there wasn't one state he won that he didn't win.
Yes.
California.
Yes.
He said he won.
Right.
Like, if I wanted to say that I really won Wisconsin when I lost by 19,000 votes, right, or Arizona by 11,000 votes, I would just be all in on an Arizona argument and, right, and a Georgia argument and a Wisconsin argument. But then I go, and also this other state I lost by 4 million, I really, yeah, won that too.
Right.
But they were stuffing ballots with 4 million and one votes.
Yeah, it's even Rolling Stone popped in with their own assessment. They all have. It's almost like there's a limited thesaurus here for ways to describe a Trump speech. So here, you know, from let's see, SACB, we got a lengthy falsehood riddled speech. From Rolling Stone, we got an hour and a half rambling speech. Demeaning Joe Biden's cognitive abilities, et cetera, et cetera. And then says that he denied that Trump dismissed climate change issues. Trump also dissed, here's the report from Rolling Stone, Trump also dissed California and its governor, Gavin Newsom, for the state's water shortage. Fair enough. But here's where Rolling Stone jumps in with its own opinion, which has been a result of warming temperatures and low precipitation attributed to climate change, per the California Office of Environmental Health Hazard Assessment. So let's quote an appointee of Gavin Newsom's to argue that any water problems in California are about climate change, and therefore Trump can't be right, that it can't be something else. So that's Donald Trump. Meanwhile, over at, I believe this was at NBC, on Meet the Press.
I just want to make sure, because you're not reading it, I just want to make sure everyone knows the closing line of this.
Please.
I always hear Republicans can't win California. You can't win, Trump said. I will tell you, if God came down and God was the vote checker, I believe we'd win California. I'm sorry. You believe this I'm guy sorry. Is, I mean, this is our guy. This is who we nominate.
That's,
I just am not even, I can't, I just don't even know what to say.
Well, let's save it then here for, you know, we got Trump at CPAC. We've got Gavin Newsom on Meet the Press on Sunday, where he made 3 points, said any talk of his presidential aspirations is a Republican smear. He used the word canard. He defended Joe Biden in a way that was truly remarkable. We'll get to that. And he rolled out his red state abortion rights advertising campaign. As far as not running, he said it's a damning conversation, frankly, the other side wants us to have. I'm deeply mindful of the anger machine and all the entertainment industry out there on Fox and elsewhere. They love ginning this stuff up about his desire to run for president. Defending Joe Biden, Gavin Newsom said, in my favorite remark of that the entire interview, no, Biden's not old, he said, quote, it's because of the wisdom and character that's developed over years that we have the CHIPS and Science Act, the infrastructure bill, the PACT Act, and safer communities. He's basically saying that Joe Biden is so wise because of his age mm-hmm. that he has introduced all these amazing policy solutions to problems. Yeah. Any thoughts there?
I think that's the right. I think
right
that's
answer.
That's what you should say.
Okay, good, fair enough.
I mean, I don't like. Do I think it's true? No,
but
I think it's the right. The political way of dealing with Reagan's age was to in a very charismatic,
yes,
and amenable way go to the experience and wisdom mm-hmm. card. It's one of the most famous moments in presidential debate
Mondale,
history.
Right?
Mondale,
yeah,
Mondale and started cracking up on stage. Said I knew. I walked off stage. Said I knew. I lost the election.
Yeah.
And I think that it was a charming moment. Reagan had a self-deprecating talent.
Yes.
But in this case, I think Biden even deserves credit for CHIPS Act?
That's.
I mean, I don't even think CHIPS Act is something I'd be bragging about. I signed one of the biggest acts of corporate welfare mm-hmm. ever. I'm giving a whole bunch of money to NVIDIA.
Yeah.
That just became a $3 trillion company,
right.
a $2 trillion company, and I'm giving money to... So it's a bad piece of legislation riddled with all kinds of woke attachments that are an embarrassment. But even if I were proud of it, it was a bipartisan thing that had to be brought to Biden. He didn't help orchestrate it. But it doesn't matter. It's legislation that you want to brag about, and your guy did pass it. And he is old.
Mm-hmm.
So what else are you going to say besides his wisdom helped yes. get it passed?
Yeah, there you go.
So I'm fine with that.
That makes sense. So I want to do this one part of the interview because we've got some audio here that Lucas will play for us. But I think what's really fascinating is that Newsom also used... So first he's denying that he's running for president. But then, as the all the reporters point out, he's got millions banked from the last failed recall attempt against him. And just as a quick footnote here, it's important, and this will become more material in just a moment, but it's important to remember that in a recall election, there are no campaign finance limits. You can give a candidate as much, a politician, a public official, as much money as you want. You can give as much as you want to the campaign, to any PAC. It is unlimited. And Newsom ultimately knew that he was going to just kick butt. So he just banked tens of millions of dollars and put it in this pack that he's created so that he can advertise abroad. And when I say abroad, I mean in other states. And this ad that he is targeting right now features a young girl who is handcuffed to a hospital gurney because she came in looking for an abortion. But I want to really focus on this one part where Kristen Welker, I think that's who it was on Meet the Press, who was interviewing him, tried to...
Is she the new host?
I think she is. Pardon me for not watching Meet the Press every Sunday, but famously Chuck Todd left.
I watched it for most of my life.
I bet you did, even when you were like 9.
I could not. Oh, younger than that.
Yeah, really. I believe.
I'm telling you, Chuck Todd became unwatchable for me, and I stopped watching it.
Mm.
And then I think that Kristen Welker replaced him, and she makes my skin crawl.
Well, this is fascinating. I'll be interested to see what you think of this, uh-huh. because this is a direct question she asks Newsom. They're talking about abortion, about his ads that he wants to run in red states that will encourage people to come to California and get an abortion, and encourage them to think poorly of their own home state for any limit on abortion. And before we play that tape, Lucas, I just want to say one last thing, that he's aiming this ad specifically at Tennessee. That's where it was started to run on Sunday. And in Tennessee, what's at stake is not pro-choice or some kind of abortion abolition bill. It's simply a bill that says minors must have their parents' approval to get the procedure, to get an abortion. It's parent notification, which at least let's give Newsom credit for consistency. Here in California, he also opposes parent notification. You know, we've talked on this show before, David, about how Cal Policy Center helped draft a policy for Assemblyman Bill Asaley when the assembly would not hear this bill, which simply said parents deserve the right to know if their kids are being transitioned at school. You should call them. And Newsom's response, Rob Bonta's response was, kids will die if we do this. If we notify their parents will kill these children who are transitioning out of a legitimate grievance with how God gave them their body.
Yes.
So parent notification and abortion, same thing. So as I say, give Newsom some credit for consistency on this. That's all Tennessee's bill says is parents have a right to know what their minor daughter is up to if she's going to undergo a surgery. But when the subject comes back to abortion, Welker asks Newsom, like, is there any limit on abortion for you? Any limit at all? So why don't you go ahead and play that for us, would you, Lucas?
Well, let me press you, though, Governor. Do you think there is a week that access to abortion should be banned?
I think we've established that firmly in the context of what states are doing, like California, where we establish a constitutional right to access abortion. And at the end of the day, I think that's a determination for women
at
and their doctors. As it relates to the issues in California, we've established that firmly in the state constitution. As it relates to getting into the debate around late-term abortion, that's a complete canard.
Getting into the debate about late-term abortion is a complete canard.
So there you go. That means it's something that is so grotesque that Republicans make it up to poison the well, right? The only reason why it'd be a canard is because we all know it's wrong. And this microphone just healed itself.
I like it.
You see what I'm saying?
Yes. Yeah. It's
what you mean to say then is I favor it at 16 weeks because obviously I know that a 25th week abortion is just incomprehensible.
Right.
But he won't say it.
Right.
Now, if you do think it's a canard, meaning it's an exaggeration, I'm fine with saying that you think that they are taking a rare number of instances and trying to make it a normative point. Mm-hmm. But the problem is, it should then you tell us what your normative point is.
Right.
Like, here's something I'll say. I don't think there's a whole lot of high schoolers that are going around gang raping women.
Right.
But I'm against high schoolers gang raping women. How did I deal? Moral clarity.
You answered the question. Thank you.
I think it is rare. Maybe it's never happened.
Yeah.
I do know that if it is or did or in the future might, it's disgusting and wrong.
It's an outrage.
So why not just answer the question?
I think it's because the answer is unseemly. The truth is unseemly. It is politically untenable. So, you know, Newsom comes back in that same interview and says that what's going on in places like Tennessee is, quote, not just a war on reproductive health care. It's also, and here's the key phrase, it's also a war on women. And then here's my favorite sub clause. It's also a war on women more broadly defined. Is it women who are more broadly defined or war that is more broadly defined? He says it's also a war on women more broadly defined, including, as we know, contraceptives. I choose to think that either way he's wrong. I guess you could say that more broadly defining a war just means that, you know, limiting somebody's access to abortion in his mind is, you know, the equivalent of some kind of war. But I just thought it was challenging to figure out whether or not it was women.
I think that part, too, like the brand of Gavin is, you know, I wonder, honestly, what Andrew Cuomo would say. Andrew Cuomo's pro-choice. Andrew Cuomo would have the Democrat line, but he's at least rhetorically on this kick about, like, we have to cool down the rhetoric and argue with one another in good faith. Like, if I were a pro-choice Democrat, I would not say the pro-lifers are declaring a war on women. I would say they have a different opinion about the beginning of life.
Mm-hmm.
And that my opinion is that life begins at a different date and therefore the woman should make this decision with her doctor.
Mm-hmm.
I find that opinion to be wrong morally and legally. But that's what I would say if I were a pro-choice Democrat. Mm-hmm. But I swear to you, if I were a pro-choice Democrat, I would have total respect for for just pro-lifers in general, regardless mm-hmm. of partisan affiliation. Because they're obviously not forming their view based on being anti-women.
Right.
whether they're right or wrong.
Correct.
The view is coming from a certain belief about sanctity of life and the yes. and the legal obligation to protect the life of the unborn.
Yeah, and for a guy who proclaims, as Biden does, his own Catholicity, you know, Newsom frequently refers to the fact that he was raised Irish. He was an Irish person by birth and Irish American and raised a Catholic. I would think he would understand that. There are lots of us out here who are really skeptical about abortion. And when I say that, I mean, I am also equally open-minded to listening to people who've been through the process and who really feel like, you know, what a tragedy for them. I don't hate those people. I understand their motivations. But this is just, you know, pure cynics. But what can you do? I mentioned earlier that, you know, Newsom had all this cash. It's in his campaign for democracy, this PAC that he seeded with millions of dollars in donations left over from the 2021 recall. You and I spoke.
By the way, that part, I mean, you want to get to the money thing. I just want to say back to what he said. It's offensive.
Yeah.
That people are bringing this up. That's the funniest thing. Because obviously everyone knows he was in the position where he couldn't run and he wanted to be the front runner at whatever point Biden was either going to mm-hmm, choose not to mm-hmm. run or couldn't run. So this idea, like if it's offensive, you did it.
Mm-hmm.
Like what do you mean it's offensive that we think you're going to try to sneak in?
Right.
You wanting to debate Ron DeSantis on Fox yeah. News?
Right.
I didn't do that. You yeah, did it.
Right.
I mean, this is just so stupid.
Yeah, this is. Offensive. Yeah, that's why, you know, this most of his political speech is pure spin. But that one, that this is a canard and, you know, the Democrat or the Republicans rather want to paint us into a corner. I'm not running. But by the way, let me show you this new ad campaign. I'm running in Tennessee, you know, just in case I decide to run, I suppose. So, you know, we mentioned this recall. You and I at the time in 2021 said that the great danger here was not that Newsom would be taken down, but that more likely he would not be taken down, but would be able to bank millions of dollars. And so he has. And now we see the outcome. But that hasn't stopped the folks who were behind that 2021 recall for announcing they're ready for round two. I think in talking to some of the activists involved in the campaign, and they're not speaking for the campaign, I want to make that clear, they say that, in fact, it is important that the public know now that why Gavin Newsom is so hated in his home state by some people, and that they want to warn people nationally. And they think the best way to do that is to smother him with the heavy blanket of a recall campaign. What will really happen, of course, is that lots of people will be unleashed on the left and among, you know, corporate types in California to prove their fealty to the great man by donating millions and millions of dollars to fight the recall, which Newsom will be able to deploy any way he wants, including in promotion of his own federal race for president, right? So I look at this as really an opportunity, I think, to help Newsom fund a presidential campaign, if not 24, then perhaps 28. From a story that was in, I believe this is the LA Times, they contend the governor is too busy, the activists in the recall campaign do, is too busy occupying himself on national politics while the state is racing to close a massive budget shortfall. Last week, the nonpartisan LAO, the Legislative Analyst Office, projected the state budget at about $73 billion deficit, nearly double Newsom's own forecast. So one of the consultants involved is an Orange County consultant, Ann Dunsmore. She had this to say, California needs a full-time governor who is fully focused on the serious problems of this state and its citizens. This may be our last opportunity to rescue and restore our state while we highlight for the rest of the country the destruction Newsom has left in his wake. David, let's move on to other politics here. Katie Porter, being interviewed on CNN, says that the killing of one person by an illegal immigrant should not reshape, should not spin or misshape our immigration policy. This comes in the wake of the young woman at, I believe it was University of Georgia. She's a Georgia college student for
yeah.
sure.
Yep.
And I think her name was Laken Riley. I have that in my notes here somewhere. Pardon me for not having that totally well ordered. But Porter appears on CNN and says, well, I think what a horrible tragedy like this happens, she means when a tragedy like this happens, I think whenever we're dealing with violent crime, there's a sense of outrage, of sadness and loss. But I think the important thing is to focus on is any one instance shouldn't shape our overall immigration policy, which has so many facets, including economic choices about what workers to allow in and how to create prosperity in America. So the situation is tragic and it's a loss, and it's important to acknowledge all that. But big but. Also to recognize all the other, how all the other parts of immigration policy fit together. That's just me reading from the transcript here. So, I remember that there were cases where people had written essays about, you know, real vile people getting into the country. And I've tracked down this one from Hannah Davis over at Heritage. She wrote this about a year ago. And it is replete with examples. In 2023 alone, she writes, Border Patrol agents have encountered thousands of illegal aliens who turned out to have prior criminal convictions, including assault, rape, murder. True extent of their crimes committed by illegal aliens remains unknown because there's over 1.5 million unaccounted for. A 2021 Department of Justice report reveals that just 7%, though non-citizens represent just 7% of America's population, they account for 64% of federal arrests in 2018. That's a report from the Justice Department in 2021. Several chilling examples she offers, because we may have sensitive listeners. I won't describe every single one of them, but let me just say there's a dozen or more examples this person offers us of people who were murdered in particularly gruesome ways in the U.S. by people who were here illegally. And in the case of the young woman who was murdered in Georgia, we find out that her killer, a guy named Jose Antonio Ibarra, who came here from Venezuela, killed Lake and Riley after he had been arrested by the Customs Border Patrol in 2022 and released, and then was arrested again in New York City for having committed injury to a child. Now, I don't know what that means, and it's just not been clear in any of the reporting I could find, but serious injury to a child sounds deadly serious. And he was released there because New York City is a sanctuary city and would not cooperate with federal officials, let him out, and he then pops up in Georgia just in time to murder a young college student on a jogging on a track at the school.
Hey, did you watch the video with Aaron Burnett at CNN when Katie Porter said this?
I did, yeah.
Did Aaron Burnett push back at all?
No, not that I could tell.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that
there was a time she was a credible reporter. She's become a complete sellout.
In fairness, I looked at a very truncated clip, so it's entirely possible that Aaron Burnett did. But
I see. It's the clip that's embedded at Daily Caller.
That's the one, yeah.
Yeah, so they may have truncated.
They may have. So in fairness, you know, Aaron Burnett, CNN, may not be culpable of anything here, except giving a platform to a person who is really just under-equipped to run in any kind of political race and now wants to be a U.S. senator from California.
Well, that's certainly true. The Democrat Party's policy on immigration, the facilitation of fraudulent migrant claims, the existence of sanctuary cities, all of these things they have to own. If all Katie Porter was saying was that when you have one extremely bad thing that happens that is not connected to the underlying policy, it is unfair to gauge the policy on one outrageous exception to the rule that is not a rule, that as a matter of basic logic and prudential policymaking, I would be completely
right
in agreement with Katie Porter. The issue here is that that's not what is going on. I don't think it is a very big majority of those that are here illegally or committing violent crimes, but it's more than one. It is statistically meaningful. It is a small percent, but it is all unacceptable. But also, if there were not violent crimes being committed, the entire structure of their policy is still wrong. Right. So in other words, she's saying, like, if what I would say is, hey, don't judge our border policy because of this awful murder. Judge it because of all the other reasons it sucks. that would be kind of like what she, I don't know. I think there's a sense in which I found myself wanting to, like, be sympathetic, because I don't like the nut-picking, which is sort of an extreme case of it, applying as something normative out of what is really kind of an exception, not the rule. In this case, though, the problem is the rule itself the Democrats are so wrong on.
Yes. Let's move on to, I highlighted this one for you in our notes, David. I call this four March 5th races to watch. March 5th, Tuesday, coming up here. And we've got a pile of elections all over the state. And rather than focus on some of the real primary races, I just wanted to say that there are four that I'll be watching, David, and I recommend these to our listeners, just, you know, as kind of signposts for where things might be headed. And I'm not by any sense saying this is exhaustive. When people ask me, like, which races are you watching? This is what I tell them. You and I have already discussed number one. That's Proposition 1, in fact. That's Gavin Newsom's bid to get $7 billion for mental health care for the homeless. You and I have already discussed this at great length in a previous podcast. But, you know, this we've had Gavin Newsom now saying for 20 years that he was going to cure homelessness, either as mayor of San Francisco or as governor. And he has spent in the last 5 years about $20 billion, and homelessness has actually grown in that time since 2018. So $20 billion yields an increase. He wants about $7 billion more. And it will, as we said before, really not do what he says it'll do. 11,000 new homes and rehab beds. This is still part of that failed Housing First policy, which says all you need to give a homeless person to make them not homeless is a home. Then they're not homeless anymore. Most of them need rehab. So some of this goes to rehab. But that's about $600,000 per bed, $600,000 per bed that he wants to pay for to serve just a fraction, about 11,000 people. Principal and interest on that, we're talking about $310 million for about 30 years. So this is another huge hit to the budget, which he, Newsom, will push off to future generations. In 30 years, I will no longer be here, likely, at the actuarial table. You can't believe I'm here today.
Actuarial tables?
God. Yeah, you know.
Please.
Okay, so that's one, David, that I'm watching. And as I say, you and I have talked about that one. Another one that was really interesting to me was race number two is the Orange County Board of Education, which I'm hesitant to talk about only because I am closely tied to some of the folks in that board. Mary Barkey, who has been president there. This is a conservative board. It is now a 5-0 conservative board. This Board of Education has become the target of the California Teachers Association, in part because it has become so utterly successful in blunting teacher union demands and in accelerating school choice for people, at least in the forms that California allow, and that is inter-district transfers. That's something where parents can move from one school district to another or one failed school to a better one in their own district. But it's John Fund's piece of writing in National Review that really caught my attention. Did you happen to catch that one?
I did, and right now it's not opening on my computer, but I read it previously, but I have every other piece open. I think there's something going on the NRO website, but there was something I wanted to highlight from it. John Fund's very solid on this issue.
Yes. Yeah, he's really good. While you look for that, I'll just say he says, politics at the local level now often centers on races for school boards as parents, infuriated by the woke politics of public schools, clash with progressive teacher unions, which often elect the very school boards they then negotiate with on contracts for their members. Perhaps, Fund continues, the battle that puts those fights in sharpest relief will take place on March 5th in California's Orange County, where three seats on the county's five-member Board of Education are on the ballot. He lays out the reasons that this school board has been particularly effective, you know, and as I mentioned before, approving a huge number of charter schools, opposing critical theory, supporting parent notification. This is the school board that not only, and full disclosure here, accepted as its own document the white paper that I wrote for them on COVID and schools in the late spring of 2020. In which, you know, I looked at all the science, interviewed a bunch of doctors, and concluded there is no reason to keep schools locked down. It will do more harm than good. And this was a widespread opinion. This was not unique to me or CPC or this podcast where you and I talked about this at great length, pointing out that kids were not getting, passing on, or dying from COVID at anything like the rate everybody else did. In fact, even today, the number of kids under 18 who died from COVID is 0.0%. 0% of the total. Who died? Old people and people with underlying comorbidities. We all remember that. So this board endorsed that paper's findings and was shot up, almost literally, by teacher union progressives who tried to shut them down. So this still has them itching. And, you know, we've got video at CPC of these teachers meeting on public Zoom calls, calling for this board to be recalled as a kind of a test path for their way to destroy other school boards around the county, around the state that they don't like. So I'm going to be watching that one real close on March 5th, David. Did you find the line you were looking for?
Well, just I wanted to point out that he said something that I very rarely see people point out, that when they passed their motion, it was 4-1 to fully reopen schools without requiring masks, that it was not binding on the county's 28 school districts.
Right.
There was a total subsidiarity in the way it operated. And not only was I utterly thrilled with the content of what they did, but the process. And John pointed that out.
Yeah.
So if I were, again, if I was inside of a district that then was going to reopen, and the county board had passed something allowing it but leaving it within our discretion, I was not forbidden. In other words, they did not force this
right.
to happen.
That's right.
And I don't understand why that doesn't get covered. You would think civil libertarians would be really thrilled with the way they went about
Absolutely.
It.
Yeah, this was always offered as guidance to the local school districts in Orange County. Yeah. It was not, you know, there was no attempt on the part of this board to shut down those school districts. And further, this was the county board of education, the one county board of education that actually sued Newsom over the school closures and his emergency orders to do that. So this has been a, you know, this has been a board that put itself in the crosshairs of the far left and the Newsom lovers. Election issue number three is the LAUS school board race. There's a lot of amazing candidates there running against teacher union hacks. One of those I just want to highlight is a guy named Khalid Al-Alim, who was in not only endorsed by the United Teachers of Los Angeles, but has also been the beneficiary of their walking teams. You know, they have deployed, the teachers union has deployed hundreds of teachers into that district to support Al-Alim. And it turns out the guy's an anti-Semite with an affection for the Nation of Islam tracks and pornography and guns, which he proudly displayed on Twitter.
Only one of those three things is a problem.
I agree with you.
For the left.
Yes. They don't care about anti-Semitism. They don't care much about porn, but boy,
I mean,
the
anti-Semitism could very well be a feature, not a bug.
I think in the case of the LA Teachers Union,
the
it certainly
porn,
is.
The porn thing, it might be a feature for some, a bug for others, but let's call it a draw. But the guns thing, you just can't have that.
You can't have that. So this is a story by LA Times reporter Howard Bloom, and I know that I bag on the LA Times quite frequently, and I think deservedly. But Howard Bloom is an education reporter there who I really admire. And full disclosure, he and I worked together. He was at LA Weekly. I was at OC Weekly. We interacted an awful lot. And I still have tremendous respect for his reporting. This was a great story. And 2 days later, the teachers union, after an emergency meeting, decided that maybe Mr. Al-Alim was not for them after all. Just one quick example. So to praise, he tweeted about 18 months ago, according to Howard's story, proposing that the book from the Nation of Islam, The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, How Jews Gained Control of Black America, the book accuses Jews of stealing prosperity from black people, their 40 acres and a mule, and of collaborating with and even financing racial terrorists such as the Ku Klux Klan. That's right, ladies and gentlemen. According to Nation of Islam and Khalid Al-Alim, the teachers union erstwhile candidate for school board in L.A., believe that Jews financed the Klan. This will come as a huge surprise to Jews who were murdered by the Klan and otherwise terrorized. But there it is. One other note about the phony outrage about Alim was that the L.A. County Federation of Labor also suspended campaign activities on behalf of Mr. Al-Alim. The Labor Federation reported spending no funds, but its action, Howard notes, is symbolically notable. Here's their statement. In a world where our most vulnerable communities are experiencing increased instances of hate and violence, we expect our endorsed candidates to embody values that promote equity and diversity. That from the L.A. County Federation of Labor, which, David, you'll remember, was the meeting, they were the host of the meeting at which LA's Latino political establishment, including the Federation's president, Ron Herrera, maligned black people, maligned people, Mexican immigrants from Oaxaca, because they are short and ugly, according to one of these local officials. And Herrera, subsequently, when a secret tape of that meeting emerged, Herrera quickly resigned. So
the only thing I want to say is that he said,
Mr. Al-Alim?
He's running to be a superintendent of a school where presumably they're going to teach English. And he said, we not burning or banning our future. We not playing.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I just point out that regardless of the content, I think that grammatically we have some issues.
I think it would be more fun and not surprising at all to find out that the guy's like an English grammarian from Harvard and that he does this in order to pass in the community, but I could be wrong. Final race to watch, David. This is actually a two-for-one deal.
I will say, maybe this isn't Howard, your friend, but it could be the general coverage. You point out that he's liked posts with Kyrie Irving and Kanye West.
Right.
With Kyrie's persona non grata for the left because of vaxes, and Kanye's obviously persona non grata with the
Trump.
With Trump, and then also he just lost his mind. But like, what are the odds that he also liked Louis Farrakhan and others that are, I mean, just the Nation of Islam in general, you know, that's also overtly anti-Semitic, and it doesn't get the same call out. People have been liking Louis Farrakhan and Nation of Islam postings that were anti-Semitic. Al Sharpton has his own show on MSNBC for years, and we know what he said about Haimetown in New York in the 90s. So like, it's kind of a easy example.
Yeah, there's a layup.
Just saying.
A layup, Kyrie Irving.
But look, at the end of the day, Will, I hope you agree with me. We not burning.
No.
We not playing.
We're not playing. We. Not
no,
playing.
Not where.
Sorry. Yes. I just can't break the habit. Okay, so the fourth story to watch, and as I say, this is really a twofer. It's from San Francisco. Here's the headline. Critics attack London Breed's billionaire-backed police ballot measure as dangerous to the public. Here's the story. The crime has gone nuts in the city, but not everyone is supportive of this, of London Breed's solution, because it involves police. From the San Francisco Chronicle, be backed by Mayor London Breed, Proposition E would allow the police department to more easily set up surveillance cameras across the city. It would loosen rules around police chases and lessen the amount of paperwork police officers are required to submit after use of force incidents. It would also diminish the power of the San Francisco Police Commission. Critics say the measure is racist because police are racist. They use as evidence the fact that though blacks represent just 5% of the city's population in San Francisco, 44% of San Francisco PD arrestees are black. It is classist because tech millionaires, whom the Chronicle calls super rich, back the measure. If you add super to anything, it's great. Just ask people in the NFL. And protesters have showed up outside those companies' offices to rally against the measure. And here's Assistant Public Defender Angela Chan, who is among the critics of London Breed's measure, Proposition E. Quote, "For each provision in this ballot measure, we need to do the opposite. We need less surveillance, more respect of privacy rights. We need fewer police pursuits in one of the densest American cities, not more. We need more independent oversight, not less. And we need use of force to be more transparent, not less." Breed put out the proposition because, of course, crime is a problem in San Francisco. This is not merely a kind of a narrative of the far right and the Fox Entertainment people, as Newsom would have it. And the mayor is also in a very tough re-election campaign against two main challengers, Mark Farrell and Daniel Lurie. Both of those candidates, it should be noted, those are her tough. That's her toughest competition. Both support Proposition E. So, David, that's what I'm going to be watching Tuesday. And just a reminder to our listeners that I'll be watching that from probably an airplane as I land in Nuremberg. So I'll be gone next week. Finally, David. You know, speaking of San Francisco, I just want to talk about a couple of final stories here, and then we'll get out of here. A story in The Economist, how San Francisco staged a surprising comeback. The Economist, as a reporter after my own heart, begins the whole story about San Francisco's resurgence, its surprising comeback, as she calls it, by going to Ghent in modern-day Belgium. That was at the core of the burgeoning global wool trade in the 13th century. The first initial public offering took place in Amsterdam in 1602. London was the financial center of the first wave of globalization during the 19th century, and today that city is San Francisco. She makes this argument because she says there's a breakthrough in technology. It's artificial intelligence that has caused a bull market in American stocks, in which many people hope will power a global productivity surge. Almost all big AI startups have their headquarters in the Bay Area, which includes San Francisco and the Silicon Valley. OpenAI is there, of course. So are Anthropic, Databricks, and Scale AI. Tech giants, including Meta and Microsoft, are also spending heavily on AI in the city. According to Brookings Metro, a think tank, last year San Francisco accounted for close to a tenth of all generative AI job postings in America. More than anywhere else, David, in America, New York, with four times as many residents, was second. So the question she asks, how is this happening in a city that's falling apart? And her argument is, they do have a problem with public safety in San Francisco. This alone, this surge in AI investment and job offerings, even though the headline says it's a surprising comeback, it's not clear when you actually get down into the story, David, that this AI investment bull market is going to actually have the impact of helping the city bail itself out of public safety problems. What do you make of this, David? This idea that...
I mean, first of all, the net number is not presented.
I noticed that. I'm not a numbers guy, so I wanted to ask...
The net number is negative.
Tell me, what do you mean by that?
The gross number of new jobs that have come to San Francisco as a result of AI, minus the jobs that have lost, that have left San Francisco total because of the post-COVID reality, is a negative number. I mean, wouldn't that be the operative number for this article?
It would seem to be the most important. It's not in there. And in fact, to find out what total employment in the region looks like, you have to go elsewhere. I found a story from the Mercury News.
But also, it says a financial database at the start of 2014, firms in the Bay Area attracted four times more venture funding by end of 2020, two and a half times as much. So it's a downward trend of funding in San Francisco-based companies, and then that ends at 2020. And since then, I know that the funding is totally dried up.
This has been a global story.
Yeah.
So this seems like a wild dart game in an English pub when the darts have gone awry. But in the Mercury News, we get a story: the Silicon Valley job boom ends for now as employment growth slows down. So at the same time that we're talking about, you know, growth in the tech industry, and that's what, you know, Silicon Valley generally means all the way up into San Francisco. Silicon Valley's job boom has hit a pause, this reporter characterized it as. And while the region is still adding workers, the pace of hiring was markedly slower in 2023 than the year before. A new report shows over the one-year period that ended June 2023, Silicon Valley added about 2,700 jobs. The report determined that's a sharp slowdown from the 88,000 jobs. So 88,000 versus 2,700 that the region added the year before.
Yeah, this just strikes me as an article that was written as a gnat in search of a windshield.
Did you just make that up?
Mm-mm.
That's really good.
Thank you.
Wish I'd thought of that. All right. Last story for us today, David, and then we'll get out of here. Critical race theory ban at Temecula Valley Unified stands for now, judge rules. That's from the LA Times. So just to refresh our listeners' memories, because you and I have covered the story of Temecula Valley Unified, they decided to follow along with a few of the school boards that CPC is working with and block critical race theory instruction in the classrooms. A Riverside County judge ruled that a group of parents and teachers who wanted to stop that didn't have grounds to do it, that he didn't see really any real problem with this. Pardon me. The LA Times characterizes critical race theory this way. It's a legal framework taught at some universities that examines how racial inequality good heavens, pardon me, that examines how racial inequality and racism are systematically embedded in American institutions. It is not just a legal theory taught at some universities. It is taught in schools of public education, in the Cal State system and the UC system. In fact, we have countless examples in California of departments of education at these Cal State schools refusing to allow their teachers to intern anywhere where critical theory is being suspended because they regard CRT as not just a legal framework and not just one that's being taught at some universities, but that is being taught in their teacher courses as a reliable way of understanding, you know, a pedagogical tool, as one of them called it here in Southern California. So on Friday, Judge Eric Keene denies the request to suspend the ban on critical race theory. He rejects the argument that the district's policy is unclear. In an 8-page ruling, he says the board's resolution sets out very specific elements of critical race theory that cannot be taught. He added that resolution, this is from the LA Times story, he added that resolution limits the resolution limits instruction on critical race theory to a subordinate role within a larger instructional framework, and it focuses on the flaws of the curriculum. He says, it seems clear to the court that a person of ordinary intelligence, ouch, would have a reasonable opportunity to know what is prohibited, as what is prohibited is set out specifically in the resolution. He goes on to say of the parent notification policy, and again, all parent notification says is if your kid is going to be sexually transitioned at school, the parents must be notified. That's all it says. He writes, that policy applies equally to all students in the district, is gender neutral, does not expressly single out transgender or gender nonconforming students, as it really applies to any student's request to change their school official or unofficial records. What he's saying there is that if you go to the school district as a student and you try to change the way in which you are referred to, named, you know, whatever, changing your student your records, the parents have a right to know that. It's about transparency. So big win for parents and for brave public officials out in Temecula Valley, and a big loss for Rob Bonta.
Where does it go from here?
Well, this is only a preliminary decision. The judge is expected to make his final order, but everybody I talk to who's you know, a graduate of a law school and barred in California to talk reasonably tells me it is rare for a judge to make this kind of declaration and then reverse it in his final statement. So for now, he's just saying that this case gets, you know, the case will go forward, but he is not going to stop Temecula Valley. This was just an effort to stop it now because these parents, backed by the teachers union, had declared an absolute health catastrophe if this was allowed to go through.
Yeah.
All right. So, David, that's all I've got. Anything else for you?
No, my friend, you had a lot of good stuff in there today.
Well, thanks to you, and thanks to all of our listeners for spending their time with you and me. You can always find Radio Free California on the National Review website, but it would be easier for you and better for us if you subscribe. You can email us your comments and story suggestions. That's how I literally got almost all of these stories. Thank you, dear listeners. On behalf of my friend and co-host David Bonson, we give thanks, as ever, to session producers Lucas Klaus, Brian Tong, and Glenn Hall, and also to our friend at National Review, that's podcast producer Sarah Schutte. Thanks also to Metalachi, that's the LA-based mariachi metal band, for our music. La Revolución continúa en la semana próxima.